You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a key Wisconsin board rejected one set of standards and approved a looser one for so-called forever chemicals in Wisconsin drinking water. We'll find out what that means for communities around the state. Now, the National Basketball Association celebrated the league's 75th anniversary last month. But hang on, our guest says there's more to the story. The anniversary leaves out a part of professional basketball history. Before there was the NBA, or even before the two leagues that merged to create the NBA, there was the Midwest Basketball Conference. Pro basketball historian Curtis Harris is with us today to uncover the Midwest's rich basketball history. Curtis is an adjunct professor in the Department of History at American University. Curtis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Can you tell us about the early history of this Midwest Basketball Conference? Later, it eventually merged into the NBA.
Yeah. So, the short version of the story is in 1935, the Midwest Basketball Conference got started, and it was a professional league. But it does sound like a college operation, though. You know, a Midwest Basketball Conference. So just a couple of years later, in 1937, they renamed themselves the National Basketball League. And that league went on for over a decade until 1949, when it merged with the Basketball Association of America to create the National Basketball Association. So as I always say, you do the NBL, National Basketball League, plus the BAA, the Basketball Association of America, you get the NBA, the National Basketball Association. So that's kind of the very short version of the story there.
And you make your case that the NBA with this 75th anniversary is kind of overlooking this key part of professional basketball history in the U.S. Centered in the Midwest. Why? Why are they overlooking this?
No one has ever gotten a straight answer from the NBA as to why they don't get the history correct. So they do tether their start to 1946 when that other league, the BAA, got started, and that was an East Coast league. So that was mainly in New York City, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore. Whereas the NBL, that is a Midwestern league, and it was mostly in smaller cities. So like the Oshkosh All-Stars, that was the most successful team of the NBL, but you also had the Fort Wayne Pistons, which are now the Detroit Pistons, the Minneapolis Lakers, now the Los Angeles Lakers, and several other teams like the, just many other teams I can name, but that suffices. But I suspect it's the fact that the NBL was in generally smaller cities and not the glitzy, the large metro areas on the East Coast, and the NBA would like to be associated with those larger cities with its history.
Yeah, we had an Oshkosh and a Sheboygan team here in Wisconsin.
Yep.
These were pretty popular, you said, especially in Oshkosh. Some of these mid-sized cities did pretty well with these pro teams.
Yeah, the Oshkosh All-Stars are really like the, I think the banner team for the NBL. They joined in 1937, and they stayed with the NBL through 1949. And if I remember right, my memory's getting a little hazy. If I remember right, they won the NBL title twice in their 12 years of operation. And they had a great center named Leroy Edwards, who was a three-time scoring champion in the NBL. They had some really successful teams in Oshkosh, but unfortunately they were not able to join the NBA when that league got started. So they were kind of left on the sideline in 1949.
Yeah, a big part of the story you tell is that a lot of those original Midwestern teams in the NBL still survive today in different forms, in different cities. How important, like when we look at the modern NBA, the roster of teams there, how much of that comes out of this NBL?
Yeah, so this is a really important point, and why I think people should know about the NBL is that, you know, it just acknowledges the cities like Oshkosh and Fort Wayne and other Midwestern cities that fostered the pro basketball. But these were also really smart operations, and they had the best basketball talent as a league during the 1940s. So when the NBA emerged out of that merger between the two leagues, the best players and the best teams came over from the NBL. So the NBL, they were the league that had George Mikan with the Lakers. Many other guys who listeners might be less familiar with, like Bob Davies with the Rochester Royals. But they powered the NBA. So like the first six NBA champions were all teams that came from the NBL. And so that just shows you the domination they had over the other league that went into creating the NBA.
Now, pro sports in this era were pretty heavily segregated. Basketball, no exception.
Yep.
You write that the National Basketball League, it fits and starts, did some desegregating, though they didn't always stick with it. What did we see?
Yeah, so I think this is really important for broader American history because we like to think of, we had segregation and then, flip a light switch, then we had integration, whereas it was a lot messier than that. So the NBL shows that kind of messiness, but it did show nonetheless progress toward desegregation. So the first black player in what becomes the NBL was Hank Williams, and he played for the Buffalo Bison back in 1935. But, during World War II, Team Studebaker, just love the name. As you might surmise, they were sponsored by Studebaker. Team was majority black. So they had 7 black players and 5 white players. Now it's like the first time in basketball history you had an integrated team that was majority black. And then in 1948-49 season, you had the New York Renaissance, a basketball team, a black basketball team that relocated to Dayton, Ohio to play in the NBL. And so they were called the Dayton Renaissance, but that was an all black team playing in an otherwise all white league. And that's the first time you had the only time in really professional basketball history, you had an all black team playing in a league with white players against white teams. So that just showcases kind of the integration going on in the 30s and 40s before people typically think of integration in pro basketball.
And Curtis, I got to ask, when I hear people who are very excited about the history of a pro sport, it's often baseball. You are clearly super excited about tracking the early days of basketball history. What took you there?
I come from a basketball crazy family. So my dad played basketball. My older brother and sister, they both played basketball. So I guess I had to basically get involved with basketball somehow. Like I played too, but I got into the history side of it because, as you mentioned, baseball particularly really does focus on it and champion its history. Whereas I think professional basketball, which I think the NBA deserves some blame for this, doesn't do a good job of putting out its own story and getting people excited about its history. So I feel it's really important to know about the NBL, the NBA, and these other leagues that helped foster and spread the game. Because it's just really just great stories and people to talk about when you look at professional basketball. Baseball doesn't have a monopoly on great sports stories. Basketball should be included when we talk about this stuff.
Curtis, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Curtis Harris is an adjunct professor of history at American University. He joined us for a closer look at pro basketball's history here in the Midwest, including teams in Oshkosh and Sheboygan. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about an app that helps users practice the Hmong language.
In the late 2000s, Apple popularized the phrase, "There's an app for that," highlighting the abundance of apps available for the iPhone. But when Annie Vang of Madison got into app development around the same time, she didn't see programs made in the Hmong language. Producer Hope Kerwin has more on the app she built and the way it's keeping native speakers and beginners connected to the language.
Eau Claire resident Tiffany Moa grew up speaking Hmong with her family, but as she got older, she started to lose some of her vocabulary and found herself struggling to remember words she didn't use frequently.
You go to school, you speak English only. I didn't have any classes where they taught you in Hmong, so my Hmong language wasn't utilized as much as I had wanted to.
Moa was scrolling through Facebook one day when she saw a post about an iPhone app called Hmong Phrases. The app allows users to look up words and common phrases and hear an audio recording of how they're pronounced. Moa says she immediately downloaded it, hoping to test out her memory and her grammar.
When you grow up and you don't really speak fluent Hmong, you kind of create your own little sentences and you just formulate your own way of saying things, and it's not always correct. One that I do remember looking for was, "Can I pay for this?" Even now, like if I were to go shopping at like an Oriental store, I wouldn't know how to formulate this sentence properly.
The Hmong Phrases app was created by fellow Wisconsinite Annie Vang, who it turns out is also Moa's aunt. Vang is an iOS app developer from Madison, and she built the program 11 years ago after taking an app development course at Madison Area Technical College. Vang says she was inspired by advice from her professor, who encouraged her to build something she was passionate about.
Google Translate didn't exist at that time. And the Hmong language definitely was not in Rosetta Stone or any of the other language apps that were out there in the App Store. And so I took it upon myself that, you know, I want people to know who we are, who I am. And I felt that it was important to just, you know, have a presence in the App Store and leave a digital footprint of it.
11 years, constant updates, and one major rewrite later, the app now has over 4,000 downloads. Vang says she's always looking for ways to improve the program, taking feedback directly from users and from her parents, who are her primary beta testers. She says there have been some surprising requests from users about what they'd like to see added. She's been asked for more medical terms and Hmong names from people hoping to use them for babies.
They're interested in, like, how do you say a baby name? What does it mean? How do you pronounce it? And I thought it was kind of cool. So that's a feature that I'm currently building it right now, because we're such an oral language that if you just read the word, the name, you may not know how to pronounce it.
Beyond learning words and phrases, Vang says the app also allows native Hmong speakers to practice their intonation, an important part of the mostly oral language. She says young Hmong Americans often speak Hmong stiffly or struggle to hit the right tonal marks.
I can hear that a lot in, like, the kids that are growing up there are not speaking it, like, fluently with me being an elder. Even my nieces and nephews do the same thing, where when they say they're hungry, they're saying it, like, it doesn't have the right tone markers. And so you can understand what they're saying, but they may not know that they're saying it more English than Hmong.
This is something that niece and app user Moa says she appreciates about the program. Growing up, Moa says she spoke both English and Hmong to her parents, or sometimes a combination of the two, which she and other speakers call Hmonglish.
My parents knew enough of what I was trying to say that in the spot, because they understood it, they didn't say, oh no, you're saying that wrong. They'll just answer you.
Moa says she's not sure she'll ever fully master the Hmong language, but she's motivated to keep practicing so she can one day pass it on to her children and maintain the connection to her native language.
WPR's Hope Kerwin brought us that story about an app for the Hmong language. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, the policy-setting body for Wisconsin's DNR voted on standards last week for PFAS levels in groundwater, surface water, and drinking water. We'll talk to a water policy expert about what they did and didn't pass and what happens next. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. At its meeting last week, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board reviewed proposals from the DNR on standards for levels of PFAS in Wisconsin water. PFOS and PFOA are two of the most studied versions of this group, are what are also referred to as forever chemicals, and that they don't break down well in nature or in the human body. And when they build up in the body, they've been shown to lead to different types of cancer, thyroid disease, and fertility issues. David Strifling is director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here.
Before we get into this meeting this week, can you talk about what seems like a widening number of communities in Wisconsin having concerns about PFAS chemicals in their drinking water in particular?
Yeah, we're seeing them at any number of sites, cities around the state, and DNR is looking at what I understand to be dozens of sites where there may be contamination associated with PFAS that's been found. And so people are scared. People are nervous. You know, you can hardly think of something more fundamental to life than water. And when that's threatened, it's a raw emotion that I think we're seeing around the state.
And it was an emotional meeting. I want to listen to the chairperson of the town of Peshtigo testifying. Cindy Boyle got rid of her prepared remarks. She said she was just reading other people's points. Let's listen to a little of what she did say.
My blood level's 5 times higher than the national average, people. This isn't a joke. This isn't hyperbolic. It is history. It does matter. And for God's sake, it's needed. We cannot do anything. We are all on drinking wells in the town of Peshtigo. 1/3 of our parcels are impacted. 4,000 people, 1/3 of our parcels are impacted. It continues to migrate. If we don't have state standards, there is nothing that we can do to hold our responsible party accountable to provide us safe drinking water. What does that mean? That means we all go every single day continuing to drink poison.
So what are the responsible parties? Where is this? Where are these chemicals coming from in our groundwater and our drinking water?
Well, we see them from a lot of different sources. These are just organic compounds that have been used in nonstick coatings and waterproof fabrics and firefighting foams and even food packaging. So they're coming from metal finishers and paint manufacturers. They're leaching out of landfills. They're coming from all sorts of different industrial sources, even medical products. And, you know, the mayor there said that she has a bloodstream level of 5 times the national average. And it's very likely, Rob, if you and I were tested, they'd be in our bloodstream too, as well as pretty much every other human on the planet. They are ubiquitous. They're everywhere.
Let's get into what came out of this meeting now. The DNR had asked for a standard on drinking water. Now, there's a few different categories of water. Let's start with drinking water. The DNR said they wanted to set a maximum recommendation of 20 parts per trillion. The board ended up going with 70 parts per trillion. These are small amounts that we're talking about. What does this all mean?
Right. So you might have expected the board either to say just yes or no to DNR's proposal, but instead it chose a third route at 70 parts per trillion. And in doing so, it was adopting what EPA had established several years ago as what's called a health advisory level. And so that was an unenforceable standard at the federal level, but that's where the board turned to get that number. And you know, a lot of the objection to these rules here, I think, at the state level has been along the lines of, well, we should just wait for EPA to develop federal numbers and then adopt those. The frustration is that EPA has sort of been dragging its heels on this, and a lot of states just aren't waiting for EPA. And that's why I think you saw Governor Evers direct WDNR to develop its own standards. So, you know, that's sort of a mixed bag for DNR on this particular rule. It didn't get what it wanted in terms of 20 parts per trillion, but at least putting some kind of standard in place would allow the agency to move forward with testing and sampling from municipal water utilities. Now, that's not to say the standard is in place yet. You know, we're kind of jumping ahead here, mm-hmm. but the legislature still has to approve all of these rules. So the action by the NRB doesn't mean that the rules immediately go into effect. There's another step that has to take place here.
Yeah, and supposing we end up with rules, whether it's 20 or 70 or whatever the number is, and the legislature approves it, you test a town's water supply, it's over whatever that threshold is, then what? What would happen?
Well, theoretically, the DNR could initiate an enforcement action against that municipality to bring it back into compliance. In reality, the DNR almost never comes down with a, you know, real hard hammer on municipalities. Instead, the DNR would likely work with the municipality to get it back into compliance. I think it's unlikely that DNR would impose some kind of heavy fine on a municipality who is not in compliance, especially given that the rules are so new. This would be more of a chance for the municipality to understand what the levels are in its water supply and get back into compliance with whatever the number eventually falls in at.
The board didn't pass a, as I understand this, a groundwater standard. We've been talking about drinking water. This is groundwater, but I guess if I have a well, I'm kind of interested in what the groundwater is like. What does it mean that they didn't pass a standard there?
Yeah, you've hit on exactly the point. So the drinking water standard is only going to apply to municipal water utilities, public water systems. If you are on a private well, that standard doesn't help you. It doesn't apply to your well. And I think that's why we heard that raw emotion from the mayor of Peshtigo there, because, you know, their residents are on primarily private water wells. So, you know, what this means is there's no established level or rule that the DNR can enforce on for private wells. Now, of course, that has important implications for people who draw their drinking water from those wells. It also means that DNR is hamstrung in its ability to make polluters clean up groundwater that has above that, you know, whatever the number would have been, 20 parts per trillion, I think. of that concentration in groundwater. So it's kind of a multi-pronged issue there, but you're absolutely right that this takes away protection for those who are on private drinking water wells, not on municipal water systems.
This one was a
big blow to DNR, I would say.
A lot of what we're talking about deals with existing PFAS in ground and drinking water. Has anything changed when it comes to new sources, new pollutants that find their way into these waters?
Well, I think, you know, given the growing scientific consensus that these forever chemicals are harmful, they are being phased out. They're not totally prohibited yet, and so you could still see some of it coming in. I think that flow has been lessened, but you're right, a lot of the damage has already been done. So, you know, a place like Tyco and Peshtigo or Marinette, that contamination is historical. And so part of the impetus for these rules was to clean up the damage that's already been done. And, you know, that's what DNR was aiming at, I think, with some of these rules.
And then we have these board recommendations. As you say, they have to be passed by the legislature. I believe the legislature's done for 2022. Does that mean, what's the timeline then for something like this?
Yeah, that's a little bit outside my area of expertise, the legislative calendar, but it's unclear what happens next. You know, we've got to go through a standing committee here and then the joint committee for the review of administrative rules. So it could be the case if the legislature doesn't come back soon enough that these rules could be held up until it does, which could be 2023.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
David Strifling is director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. We talked with him about the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board's meeting last week where they passed some less restrictive standards for PFAS levels in drinking water that the DNR had proposed. As we heard, there'd be a road for those standards to come into effect. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Republican investigation into the 2020 elections is still going on. We'll look at the report presented this week by Michael Gabelman and find out what lawmakers are saying in response. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to two authors of a new book looking at the role of media in shaping Wisconsin as a political battleground state and how people have different communication and information ecologies in their own lives. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden gave his first State of the Union address last night. We'll talk to a Wisconsin political scientist about what we heard and about the Republican response to the speech. First, Wisconsin is well known now as a political battleground state, sometimes seen as a predictor of trends at the national level. But it hasn't always been that way, and not all issues are the same in Wisconsin as they are in other parts of the country. A group of current and former UW-Madison professors wrote a new book looking at the media channels and communication dynamics that help shape Wisconsin's partisan divides. The book's called Battleground: Asymmetric Communication Ecologies and the Erosion of Civil Society in Wisconsin. We're learning more about the research and its findings with two of the authors now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How divided do you think Wisconsin is, more than you remember in the past? What is your media diet? Where does your political information come from? Is it different than maybe the people you talk to and your family at work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Louis Friedland is a professor emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communications. Lou, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
And Mike Wagner is a professor also in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be back with you.
Well, Lou, can you talk about how this project got started and why you focused on Wisconsin in particular?
Well, Rob, the project actually got started more than 10 years ago in the wake of Act 10. And our research group started tracking what was going on in the state in terms of the degree of contentiousness, particularly the way that the politics in the wake of Act 10 was dividing people, dividing in some cases family members. And we thought that this was extreme. We thought it was remarkable. And of course, we're communication scholars, so we also wanted to understand how the communication environment, or the communication ecology, as we call it, actually might be contributing to that contention. So we've been tracking it really for almost 12 years now. And this is the largest study of a single state's communication environment, we believe, that's ever been done. We have years and years of data at every layer of Wisconsin's communication ecology. And indeed, we are finding that people, surprisingly, or not surprisingly to most people who've been following this, are really are divided, are becoming more divided, although we can see this developing over a long period of time here.
Mike, can you tell us what goes into someone's communication ecology?
Sure. It really is an understanding of all of the different elements that are at play when it comes to how we learn and decide what we believe, decide what we say and express to others, and decide what we do. And so it includes the people we talk to about politics. It includes the local television news we might watch, the local newspapers we might subscribe to or read or browse online. It refers to national television news from broadcast sources like your classic NBC, ABC, CBS. It refers to cable news that you might watch on places like Fox News or MSNBC. It relates to your social media behavior and the people in those social media networks who might share information about politics or misinformation about politics or contentious conversations with you or people you know about politics. And so it's really, you know, from who we talk to face to face to what we passively watch, read, listen to on the radio, talk radio, and news radio as well, and the social media outlets that we get information from. And those things, of course, have local elements, they have regional and state elements, national and international elements, and it is really complicated to try to figure out how all of these things are associated with what people know, want, and do, which is why I suspect nobody does it except for us. It's just, it's a lot of work.
Lou, one of the old political cliches is that all politics are local. The new political cliche is that local politics and state politics are getting nationalized. That's one of the things you tried to sort out in this book. What kind of conclusions did you draw there about how much national politics sway things in a state like Wisconsin?
Well, that is one of the big focuses of our book, Rob. And we have found that, of course, politics has become more nationalized. People take their partisan take their cues from the parties and those and national cable television environments, national media environments. But we found that really it depends more on the issue and location, that there is more variation than many political scientists would have found and expect, that depending on the issue. We looked at three issues, immigration, health, and the economy through the lens of Foxconn. We found that different people have different takes on these issues depending on, as Mike was saying a few minutes ago, their media diets or repertoires, their social networks, their geography. It's not so radically different. If they're hardcore partisans, they're likely to still take their cues from the National Democratic or Republican parties. But there's a lot of people in the middle, and that's one big lesson is that many people, maybe even most people, most of the time are still making sense of their lives and the issues through the lens of their local community.
Mike, one thing that struck me from our vantage in the media, we might get a picture that there's a lot of people out there on the left with their media diet and a lot of people out there on the right with their media diet. And that's all we might experience sometimes. There's a lot of people who just don't follow news that closely that might not be represented, say, on a call-in talk show.
That's right. There are plenty of people who did not wake up today and think to themselves, how will I hold my government accountable? Or they didn't wake up today and say, oh, I wonder who I'll hear on Central Time this afternoon. Plenty of people are in what some of our colleagues, Yana Krupnikoff and John Barry Ryan, call the other divide, right? So there's the left-right Democratic-Republican political divide, and then there's a divide between people who really are interested in politics and follow the news and have a kind of an omnivorous craving for different sources, and those who check out of politics, or they might think it doesn't affect me, or they might think no matter what I do, it's not going to matter. And so there's a lot of different reasons people might not be a part of regular engagement in politics. And so they're a group of people we ought to pay close attention to. But it's also the case that we overstate how many people are in a right-wing or left-wing partisan media echo chamber. There are certainly people who live in those kinds of spaces and consume those sorts of media and have those kinds of social media conversations. But a lot of people have very diverse information diets, because don't forget, it's not just whether you just watch Fox News all the time, it's also who you talk to at the gym and who you talk to when you're walking your dog around the block and what's on your local television news. And so it's a much more mixed set of information that most people get most of the time, which is what makes it so complicated to try to understand carefully.
We are talking to Lewis Friedland and Mike Wagner, both from UW-Madison, both co-authors, a group of co-authors involved in this book called Battleground, Asymmetric Communication Ecologies and the Erosion of Civil Society in Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Your observations about your own media diet, that of the people around you, 800-642-1234. Matt joins us now in Madison. Matt, hi.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to, I followed politics my entire life, and that I have witnessed in years is a willingness of people to accept disinformation, even outright lies. Now, some of the people believe the propaganda or the disinformation or the lies. They sincerely believe that. But there's some, I believe, that know that it's disinformation. They know they're lies, but they utilize them anyway.
Matt, thanks for the call. Lou, I know one of the things you're hoping to track in the book is how mis and or disinformation spreads, what we can do about it. Any thoughts for Matt?
Right. Well, I do want to say that how disinformation spreads is itself a whole other complicated subfield. So we're trying to create a framework in which we might track mis or disinformation, but we don't do that in the book much. That said, we do find parallel to the findings of others, like a group at Harvard who wrote an important book called Network Propaganda, that there are asymmetrical media worlds. And what I mean by that is that, not surprisingly to most of the listeners here, there's a hyper-conservative or even hyper-conservative media environment that consists of cable news, but in this state, most importantly, conservative or even ultra-conservative talk radio. And of course, then that's amplified by people's social media. So you have a kind of a end-to-end ecosystem that's relatively more closed off. The what we might call the center or the center liberal even media ecosystem, although it's not particularly as partisan and directly in any sense, is much more open, much more related to mainstream media, including WPR. So there are two, if you want to think of it this way, different media worlds, and that does, as you might imagine, tremendously affect people's susceptibility to dis or misinformation.
Thanks for the call, Matt. We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professors Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner. They're two of the authors of the new book, Battleground, looking at political conversation, communication, and media in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What sources do you use for your political media? Do you consume some kind of political media on a daily basis? Or do you try to take breaks from it? Maybe big breaks. Do you see divisions among people you know over who they turn to, who they trust for information? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with UW-Madison journalism professors Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner. They're two of the authors who contributed to the new book, Battleground, looking at the role of media and communication in Wisconsin's political divide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do conversations with people in your life shape your political views? Do you talk about politics with people in your life, or do you avoid those conversations? Where do you go for news and information? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike, one big part of the research for this book involved conversations, a couple hundred people, I believe, from around Wisconsin. And sometimes you might start with what seems like a political stereotype and things get nuanced the longer you talk to people. What kind of things did you and your colleagues learn from those conversations?
You know, that's exactly right. People are very complex, and we, you know, as social scientists and also just as human beings, right, often try to categorize the world into simple categories like liberal and conservative or moderate and those kinds of things. And what we learn when we and our students go out and talk to people and ask them what's on their mind and what issues do they care about and how do they encounter information about important matters like politics and local politics, we find people often speaking in ways that seem contradictory if you were going to try to categorize them in a neat little liberal or conservative box, right? And so we learned this time and time again in the conversations that we had with people, where someone might say, you know, it's super important to have rules about who can come into the country, talking about immigration. And then saying, but it's really important for people in my part of the state, in agricultural part of the state, to have, you know, people who are willing to come in and work hard and help us, you know, with our harvest. And oftentimes it's immigrants who do some of that work. And so then you see the openness, and then you see, but really I only want people of value to come in. And so there's people who kind of, you know, saying multiple things all about the same issue. And so if you were to ask them on a scale of 1 to 5, you know, do you support a restrictive immigration policy or not? Like, it's hard to know how you would compare a numerical answer to the richness that you get when you talk to people. And of course, we try to do both of those things and then triangulate and say, where are we hearing the same story, no matter how we measure it, and where are we hearing different stories that add a level of complexity to what it means to live in our state and think carefully and deliberately together about important and contentious political issues.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon, and Professors Friedman and Wagner. It's hardly surprising to me that communications professors would cite the media as the cause of the opinion divide in the United States. It's a bit self-serving, I think. But looking over the last 20 years, I always make sure to check after an election the national demographic maps about voting patterns. And the split is pretty clear. It's urban versus rural. The country outside of the major cities is red. The larger the city, the bluer it is.
Marcus, take your point. Thanks for calling. I don't know, Lou, that you guys were saying that the media caused the divide, but too, I think Marcus's main point, you do talk about that, and not just big cities, but if you look at Wisconsin counties, a town of a city of 1 or 2,000 is going to be bluer than the surrounding countryside. How did that play into your research?
Yeah, that's right, Rob. And I should say, we definitely are not saying the media causes this division of opinion. In fact, this study incorporated large swaths of sociology and other demographic analysis to understand what counties people were in, what their social networks were, assuming, in fact, precisely that communication isn't what's creating this. So that's actually not what we're saying. But we do find that yes, the bigger cities are bluer and the smaller cities are bluer than their rural surrounds. But nonetheless, that's part of the point, is that if you look at Wisconsin, it's not a giant red-blue divide. It's honeycombed, really. there's a series of, if you want to think of it, concentric circles where the closer you get to the core of even a smaller town, the bluer it is. Yes, not necessarily blue, I add. Could be red overall, but bluer than it surrounds. But then you go out further and it's redder, but then you start to get some overlapping circles. And that's where you get these really interesting patterns, because the state's not, quote, all red or all blue, all Milwaukee, Madison, or all, Northwest. There is a lot of overlap.
Let's go now to Dave in Augusta. Dave, hi.
Hello, Rob. Long time no talk. I've got an opinion with politics. I try to keep political discussions just among close friends and family. That may sound strange, but I tell you what, if somebody comes up to me on the street or at a restaurant or whatever and tries to tell me how they feel politically, it's a turnoff. It's a discussion that will never, ever resolve. That's the way I feel about it. Dave. You know, if somebody can't tell me, well, the reason you should go this way is because of this and this and this. Mike, well, I don't feel that way.
Dave,
well,
thanks for the call. And Mike, I'm guessing that doesn't sound strange at all to a lot of people. We're maybe more and more reluctant to want to have a political conversation, except maybe with that inner circle that Dave mentioned.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we have the two groups that Dave talked about, and then there's a third group of people who are maybe our coworkers, right? So there's our close family that many of us are willing to engage in political talk with. And then there's the people who accost you in the line at a coffee shop that I think maybe Dave is talking about, who maybe you don't want to talk about politics with. But then there are people who, you know, you work with every day, and we find that there are different patterns of communication people have with their close family and friends on the one hand, and their coworkers on the other. And the more heterogeneous the group, and usually coworkers are a more diverse group of people than one's own family, the different kind of opinions we see people ultimately end up expressing. They tend to be a little bit less extreme in their views, a little bit more willing to hear from the other side. But as the caller was mentioning, you know, it's also the case that, and maybe perhaps especially in Wisconsin, a stranger walking up to you and letting you know why your political views are wrong is probably not something that's going to solve a lot of problems in short order.
Thanks for that call, Dave. Lou, a big thing that we've only touched on briefly, social media, something that's been changing over the course of your study, a moving target to this day. What kind of questions about social media are you and your colleagues still hoping to answer when it comes to social media and how it shapes our political communication?
Well, we have an enormous analysis of Twitter in the book, and particularly the way that media elites, or I should say political elites, and also journalists use Twitter, and how Twitter shapes the public discourse across those elite layers. But of course, most people are not on Twitter doing politics most of the time. Many people really are on Facebook if they're on social media, the quote average person. And Facebook is behind a very thick firewall. So that's one of our bigger questions moving forward, is the role that Facebook plays as a center for sharing opinion among like or maybe unlike other people.
And Mike, just in our last minute or so, what is your big open question coming out of this years of research?
One thing I'm really interested in is what sorts of behaviors can people engage in, and what are kinds of journalism that reporters and news outlets can engage in that can help us reweave or re-knit together the civic fabric, right? We call our book Battleground. You can get it at go.wisc.edu/battleground for free until March 6th. And one thing that, you know, we think about in the end is, what are ways out of this kind of behavior? How can we expose ourselves to people who are different than we are, to news sources that aren't going to just tell us what we want to hear, and social media platforms where we don't get into endless arguments that serve no purpose? What can we do to re-knit together our civic fabric is a big part of our next project.
Sounds like a good starting point for another conversation sometime. Mike, thanks for being with us.
We'll do it. Thanks for having us.
And Lou, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Louis Friedland is a professor emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and Mike Wagner, a current professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communications. They're two of the authors of the new book, Battleground, Asymmetric Communication Ecologies and the Erosion of Civil Society in Wisconsin. Speaking of weaving the social fabric back, check out a conversation from earlier this week with David Haynes of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about their Wisconsin Weaver Project, looking at exactly that topic. Coming up after the news, we'll break down what President Biden said in last night's State of the Union speech and what it tells us about the administration's foreign and domestic priorities. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time